Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the show. And today I'm thrilled to be talking again with Dan Stone. Dan is professor of modern history and director of the Holocaust Research Institute at Royal Holloway, University of London. And he's been gracious enough to be on the show at least a couple times before. And I'd invite you to go back to the archives to listen to those interviews. Today, we're going to talk about his new and widely praised book, The Holocaust, An Unfinished History. So Dan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we've talked about this. You've written extensively on the Holocaust, extensively on genocide studies. And now you've decided to write maybe a broader synthetic history. Why now? What made you decide to write this book at this moment?
It's a good question. And I suppose it has a critical edge insofar as there are lots of books about the Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. So the unspoken question is, why do we need another one? And there are several ways to answer your question. The first is a personal one, which is, I feel, as a historian, able to write this book in a way that I couldn't have done 10 or 20 years ago. But I think that's not good enough in its own right as an answer. The second part to the question is, why now, in a broader sense? Yeah. And I think that's because in the last 10 years, the historiography has blossomed in all sorts of ways, in various directions. The methodologies and approaches that historians use are much more varied than they were even a decade ago. The access to sources in English, in particular, is extraordinary. The range of sources relating to the Holocaust from around Europe and beyond, in translation from every European language, is extraordinary. And thirdly, because history is never written in a vacuum, right? So we're always responding to what's going on in the world around us. The research questions that we ask don't appear out of nowhere. They're also shaped by who we are and the societies in which we live. And so the questions that we ask about the Holocaust now, I think, throw up different angles from just 10 or 20 years ago. And I guess over this conversation, we'll talk about what some of those might be.
I feel compelled to ask the obvious question, which is, the subtitle is An Unfinished History. What does that mean?
Good. Thank you, because I'm glad you asked that now, because that follows logically from the first question. And it's a similar kind of answer in a way. And I mean it in two senses. And the first is a sort of, well, I was going to say an obvious one about the Holocaust, but it's not obvious. It's obvious in the sense that it follows from some of the new directions in the historiography. And that's to say that not in a strictly chronological sense, but in a psychological or a memory sense, the Holocaust didn't end in May 1945. Obviously, and we know because there's been a blossoming of what we might call aftermath studies, so mm-hmm. studies of DP camps, of migration, of the relationship between Holocaust survival and human rights architecture in the post-war world, of the creation of Israel. And if you think about the huge literature that's been written on Holocaust memory, by which I also mean, for example, Holocaust trials from the 1940s onwards, Holocaust cinema, scandals over Nazis in the West German government or Swiss gold former Nazis becoming president of Austria, whatever it happens to be, the Holocaust's afterlife is, I think, now also part of the history of the Holocaust. And we only have to think about what's going on today and the way in which Holocaust metaphors and allegations are thrown around all the time with respect to Russia and Ukraine, Israel and Gaza, and other similar settings, that we know that the Holocaust is still a live issue. And so politically, culturally, emotionally, it's still, in that sense, an unfinished history. But I also mean, and this relates to your first question, that all history, I think, is contemporary history in the sense that the questions that we ask about the past are always changing. And there's a kind of paradox here, which is you might think, and probably listeners to this series don't think, but I think in general, lay people might think, well, surely there's nothing more to say because there's so much written. But actually, the paradox is that the subjects on which we have most written are the ones that generate more questions. And so it's hard to get hot under the collar, let's say, with apologies to the relevant historians, about, let's say, canal building in the 18th century. I'm sure there's an exciting body of historiography on the subject, but it's not, it doesn't appear in the press, you know, in on a daily basis in the same way that issues relating to the Holocaust do, whether it's about looted art in a provenance research, political statements, eradicating Nazism in Ukraine, etc., etc. So the questions that we ask about the past are shaped by the world in which we live. And the world in which we live now is a different one from 10 or 20 years ago. And you think about the current debates about the upcoming elections in the US or in the UK, in France, elsewhere in Europe, the rise of the radical right, fears about radical Islam, and so on and so forth. All of these things shape how we as historians respond to the topic that we're studying.
Yeah, and I just want to briefly note for audience that there's a very interesting and thoughtful chapter in this book about liberation and camps after the war that I'm just going to skip over here because Dan and I have talked about that in about his previous book. And so here I will just remind people and urge them to go read his book about the liberation and the camps or go back and listen to the interview. I want to be another kind of framing question. As I was thinking about your book, I was thinking about the way in which you straddle, maybe straddle is not the right word, but you are part of both academic disciplines of Holocaust studies and genocide studies. And as I've read, you know, I don't know, this is interview 130 or 140 or something like this, I'm struck by how frequently genocide studies scholars use the Holocaust as an example, and how relatively rarely people who think of themselves as Holocaust studies scholars really employ or interrogate the insights of genocide studies. So I guess first I would ask if you think I'm right about that. But secondly, I would ask as somebody who's in both, what kind of insights from genocide studies did you bring to this book?
I do think you're right on the first point. Mm-hmm. Although I'd say given the diversity of historians to on the Holocaust, that's probably less true than it was a few years ago.
Fair point.
So if you think about the increase in the number of people working on, let's say, broadly speaking, the Holocaust as a global phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So let's say Jewish migration to Shanghai or Mauritius or Bolivia, or think about the sort of post-colonial approach, which asks questions about the relationships between Jews as white Europeans arriving in places of colonial settlement, and what's the relationship between those people and the locals and the authorities and so on. Those are questions that in some ways pertain more to genocide studies than to Holocaust studies more conventionally understood. So there is, I think, a shift in that direction. Nevertheless, I think your claim is basically correct, that most Holocaust historians don't engage with genocide studies in the same way that genocide studies scholars engage with the Holocaust. I think that's true. I think it's also fair, I should say at this point, that although I used to be one of the editors of the Journal of Genocide Research for about 15 years, I'm not anymore, and I feel a little bit out of the loop where genocide studies is concerned. Nevertheless, I'm still involved to some extent. And I think it's quite a difficult question because I've thought about this a lot over the years. Because in genocide studies, if you're a Holocaust historian, you are positioned in a slightly curious way. Because there's an assumption that if you work on the Holocaust, that your view will probably be that the Holocaust is unique, it's different from other cases of genocide, therefore you probably don't really need genocide studies in that sense. And it took me quite a long time, I think, to work out that I could be committed to the idea of genocide studies and still consider myself a historian of the Holocaust, and that those two things were not in conflict and not necessarily contradicting one another. So I would say that from genocide studies, I have an understanding of genocide as an unfolding process, as something that, if you think about the old intention fungus divorced historiography, the idea that a decision was made to kill the Jews seems, I mean, that can be disproven in any case empirically, I think, but from genocide studies, you learn that such a thing is really rather unlikely, because that's not how regimes work. And so that's one insight that I think would be quite useful. And I think there are many others in terms of, and this shows even in books like Omer Bartov's book about Buchach, for example, discussions about the relations between different ethnic groups, the tensions, the friendships, both at the same time, sometimes between different groups, and the way in which an occupying regime, such as the Third Reich, changes the dynamics of the relationships between ethnic groups. That is something I think that has fed through into Holocaust studies from genocide studies. Questions about how genocides end, about perpetrator violence, about sexual violence, about post-genocide, I was going to say reconciliation, but that's not the right word, post-genocide affairs in the broadest sense, I think all have shaped now many research projects being carried out by Holocaust historians.
Let's look at the book specifically, and you talk in the introduction, and then at the beginning, toward the beginning of the book, you say that we need a return to ideology, especially regarding race. So how should we think about Nazism as an ideology, and about the way Nazism, or Nazis understood and talked about and had fantasies about race?
It's a brilliant question because, again, there's no shortage of literature on Nazi ideology. Excuse me. That said, the number of studies that focus specifically on Nazi race theory and what race meant for the Nazis is actually not that large, even though astonishingly the literature produced by Nazis, not just in the 12 years of the regime, but before that as well, is extraordinarily large. Not just in the obvious sense of the newspapers like the Völkische Beobachter or Der Stürmer or whatever, but in everything that the Nazis touched, from school textbooks through to scientific treaties to the more mythical or mystical anti-Semitic stuff, the amount of material is astonishing. And so recent books like Chaputeau's The Law of Blood, I think, is an important study because it's one that's quite unusual in the sense that it takes the Nazi thinkers seriously. I think that's something that historians have been reluctant to do for fear, I suppose, of granting Nazi ideas too much credence, suggesting that they had an intellectual tradition, being seen to be too close to Nazi ideas, and so on. And in that sense, Chaputeau, and I think something I've tried to do in the book, is to follow the lead set by Aurel Kolnai in 1938. So Kolnai, who was a Hungarian Jewish convert to Catholicism, wrote in English. He'd never set foot in an English-speaking country, but he wrote this book in English, sitting in a Nazi cafe in Vienna. And he writes these letters saying what pleasure he was taking from excoriating Nazi ideas whilst being surrounded by Nazis. He wrote this book called The War Against the West, which is 600 pages or so, and it's still one of the finest studies of Nazi thought that there is. And his starting premise is we have to take the Nazis seriously and think, take them at their own word and engage with what they are saying. And Kolnai, he consciously echoed one of the chapters of Mein Kampf, where he titled, there's a long section of his book called Race and Nations with the same title as the relevant section in Mein Kampf. And the understanding of race there is superb because he shows that for the Nazis, race is not a stable or homogeneous concept. It's one that's being contested all the time within quite broad parameters. So, of course, the Nazis in general, let's say, think that race matters, That race shapes the world and the ways in which different peoples and different cultures have evolved and how they look now. And for the Nazi leadership, there's an understanding of race in a kind of metaphysical or chiliastic sense, that the movement of world history is a struggle between good and evil, i.e. Aryan and non-Aryan races. And that is the kind of guiding leitmotif of how the Nazis understand the world as such. And Kolnai sets this out brilliantly. But when I talk about a return to ideology, I don't mean in, certainly not in a kind of simplistic intentionalist sense, which says the Nazis hated the Jews and they always wanted to kill them. There is a kind of proto-genocidal dynamic, I think, inherent in Nazism, but it's not explicitly set out either in the Nazi Party program from 1920 or in Mein Kampf or in later statements. The functionalist argument that the Holocaust developed in an ad hoc, unpredictable way is clearly correct, and we can demonstrate that. But you also then have to take another step back and say, yes, but if you only take a functionalist approach, you don't see why the Nazis targeted the Jews in the first place. Mm. So there, you have to return to ideology in that sense. And again, it doesn't just mean ideology as a political program, but in the sense that was promoted by Alon Confino. So the idea of a Weltanschauung, or a worldview. And this is the very air we breathe, as Goebbels put it. So that the racial ideologies then are not something that is simply a part of a program, but they are designed in a sort of metaphysical way to shape the way that the Nazis, and then by influence the German people as a whole, think about the world and their place in it. What I also wanted to do was to get away from, to sum up, the idea of race as a rational scientific process. Because although, I mean, clearly eugenics is important to Nazism, the euthanasia program clearly is a eugenic project in that sense. The idea that Nazism is a form of Darwinism or a scientific racism, I think, is only half of the story. And for me, the power of Nazi race thinking lies in the fact that it's not about, when it comes to the Jews, it's not about simply saying, oh, these people are subhumans, they're unesthetic, or they're damaging the race somehow. That's the argument that applies, I think, to the Roma, to the disabled, and to other groups of people. But the Nazi leadership, at least, understand the Jews, again, in this kind of metaphysical sense, as a threat to the Aryan race. And so it's here Nazi race thinking becomes a paranoid conspiracy theory. And it's that paranoid conspiracy theory that is driving, I think, a lot of what the Nazis think. So one of Kolnai's critics, Erik Fergelin, who wrote also another very fine, though philosophically demanding, study about Nazi race thinking, also in the late 1930s, he defines at one point Nazi race thinking as a system of scientific superstition. And I think that's brilliant. I cite that in the book, and I think it sums up exactly what I'm trying to say. So there is a kind of scientific basis for Nazi race thinking in the sense that the Nazis put a lot of money into racial research being carried out by biologists and anthropologists and geneticists and so on. But the very premise of that research is one that is fundamentally unscientific and is simply a belief in not just the existence of race, but in world history as the struggle between Aryan and non-Aryan races.
I'm flipping through, you and I talked a little bit earlier about the fact that I'm interviewing Daniel Feierstein later, and he writes in his new book, I'll find it eventually, that we need to think of genocides not simply as in terms of what you are erasing from the world, but also in the terms of the world you are trying to create through that erasure. And so what does that mean in terms of this Nazi imagination and Nazi ideology? What do they imagine the world will be once they have erased this Jewish presence?
I like that question because it pertains to the very concept of Holocaust. Mm. So we often hear people say that the term Holocaust is inappropriate because it's originally a name for a sacrifice, and that this is therefore not an appropriate way, this kind of quasi-religious way of thinking isn't appropriate for thinking about the slaughter of millions of people. But in fact, I think from the perpetrator's point of view, that's exactly what it was. And so the sacrifice of the Jews was precisely intended to bring to redeem Germany. So Nazi philosophy of history is a Heilsgeschichte, so a salvation history. Mm. In other words, that the elimination of the Jews will bring about the redemption of Germany and of the Aryan race. Mm. And so what that looks like is, that's harder to say, because I don't think that's set out particularly in Nazi blueprints for the future. But you have this notion of a utopian vision where the Aryan race will be able to flourish without the machinations of the international Jew seeking to destroy them at every turn. So, in other words, I guess you are left with a kind of picture of harmony and beauty where. Mm-hmm. Everybody in these beautiful villages created by Himmler in the occupied East.
You make the point that you refer to the way that I'm using slightly different words here, but anti-Semitism kind of permeated German cultural lives. And you say that historians have not yet, this is quote, taken the measure of this radical shift in German cultural life. So why did it matter that Germany is drenched in anti-Semitism, and how does that reshape the way ordinary people imagine their lives and their future?
Well, I think one of the things that tends to get forgotten in certainly the way in which Nazi Germany and the Holocaust are taught in school here in the UK, and I think perhaps in the US to some extent as well, is that Nazi Germany was a dictatorship. Mm. And it's hard for school kids these days to imagine a world without the internet, without access to information, where there's only one official point of view. And I think that's, in answer to your question, first of all, you have to imagine that as a society, a dictatorship in which there are no other points of view, and that anyone who tries to voice one has to do so extremely carefully because their safety is at risk. So first of all, everything is drenched in anti-Semitism because that's what the Nazi leadership believes. I don't think, I mean, here I would, of course, take my distance from Goldhagen. I don't think that there's some kind of innate or genetic reason why Germans are anti-Semitic. The chapter on collaboration in my book is designed to move away from that sort of argument. But I do think that and this is also an argument from genocide studies, that for genocide to take place, of course, you have to have a large number of people at the grassroots who are willing to enact that genocide. But what really matters is the leadership. And the Nazi leadership, the small stratum around, you know, by the time of the Holocaust and the rise of the SS, so Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, Eichmann, the WVHA, the whole RSHA apparatus that controls security and police and terror in Nazi Germany, these are the people in control. And for those people, they genuinely believe that the Jew is a world threat, that the Jew is trying to destroy the German race and so on. And so everything that they put out to the German public is suffused with that ideological position, whether it's, again, I don't know, ideological indoctrination sessions for the Wehrmacht, or whether it's what happens at Hitler Youth training schools, or examples in textbooks. Absolutely everything is drenched in this position. And it matters because there is no alternative. Mm. And so for people to escape from that perspective is really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you ask us to kind of flip our perspective on this period from 1933 to 1939. And you write that many people have spent a lot of time and words and effort reminding us of the fact that anti-Semitic policy is gradual and moves incrementally over time. Your point is the opposite, that if you look at this in terms of only a short 5 or 6 years, the change is remarkable. So can you say a little bit more about that and why you think it's important?
Well, this comes back to your first question, I suppose. This is a kind of response to getting older. That when I ask my students this question, they will say, yes, of course, it's a gradual process. But for me now, 5 years is not a long period of time. And so I mean, like the last 5 years feels like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think for people who were living through the 1930s in Germany, and this, and of course, a lot more discomfort than we're living in now. They're continually being bombarded from the moment that the Nazis come to power with this slew of legislation, so that by 1936-37, it's perfectly clear that the Jews already are removed from mainstream German society. They're dependent on themselves. They're proper, particularly, and this is also a very important part of the historiography that's become more prominent. The Aryanization process has completely removed Jews' ability to support themselves, with some exceptions. So the richer Jews in Germany are able to hang on longer, but they're then, of course, having to support their poorer co-religionists.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole, I think this is something that actually happens extremely quickly, because there isn't a day where you can take a breath and say, all right, now it's going to stop, because this slew of legislation is just ongoing. It's the kind of tsunami of stuff that's being delivered every day.
You cite Dirk Moses, again, bringing a genocide studies person into this dialogue, as writing that the genocide of the Jews was, from the Nazis' perspective, a subaltern genocide. For those who haven't read Dirk, what does that mean, and how does it change our perspective on the Holocaust?
I suppose that, well, there's an assumption that genocide is always perpetrated by a more powerful regime against a less powerful people. And the idea of a subaltern genocide is that sometimes oppressed peoples rise up against their oppressors, with their only solution being to kill them all, or at least to do something that we might now call genocide. And I guess this stems from the Haitian Revolution, and other similar anti-colonial uprisings that we might now regard as genocidal. The case of Nazi Germany, it's clearly, I think, objectively speaking, not a subaltern genocide, in the sense that the German people are not oppressed by the Jews. What's important is that the Nazi leadership, again, believes that they are. And so the Nazi leaders think, because they think of the movement of history as this struggle between Aryan and non-Aryan, and because they believe that the international Jew is somehow seeking to destroy the German people, that in the wake of the First World War, in the wake of the Great Depression, the chaos in Germany is attributed to the Jew, and therefore the Nazis see themselves as freeing themselves from this oppressive colonial rule of the international Jew. And it's important to be very clear. This is, of course, not in fact what is happening, but it is happening in their heads. But these are the people who are in charge. And so what's happening in their heads, I think, has a real world effect.
Yeah, you point out, this was really interesting, you point out that this paradox between the weakness of Jews as compared to the Nazis' perception of the Jewish danger remained strong, or even grew stronger toward the end of the war. So how do we understand that those fears, that perception of Jewish strength increased at exactly the moment that in reality it was weakening?
Because the Nazis were losing the war. And from the Nazis' point of view, who was in charge? The international Jew. So if you look at the Nazi propaganda, I mean, from the very start, but particularly towards the end of the war, and Jeffrey Herf's book is on the Jewish enemy is good on this, that it becomes more and more shrill, more and more violent, because there are threats of the revenge of the Jew against the German people to try and maintain a sense of cohesion and support for the regime. But who is to blame? Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, all of whom are being held in puppet strings by some hidden hand of the international Jew somewhere, who controls international finance, communism, the liberal democracies, the colonies, and so on. And so from the Nazi leadership perspective, they may have killed lots of Jews in Europe, but somehow the international Jew still remains strong. It is apparently paradoxical that when the Nazis deport the Jews of Hungary in the spring of 1944, it's perfectly clear that Nazi Germany will lose the war. But the military war and the war against the Jews are not, I think, distinct in the Nazi mindset. They are the same thing. And so even if they can see that militarily they will sooner or later be defeated, the idea of killing the Jews somehow is a contribution to the war effort.
And this will often lead then directly to a discussion about the resources that Nazis used and whether the Holocaust was a distraction from the war effort. You point out what a small percentage of the resources that were available to Germany were actually devoted to the mass murder. So how small was this percentage, and why do we tend to think that it's much bigger than it was?
Well, again, because I think people tend to differentiate the military war and from the war against the Jews. And for the Nazis, the two were the same. And so there's an assumption that, well, if Nazi Germany was losing the war, why did they devote resources to killing the Jews?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, because the two things were not distinct in the Nazi mind. And secondly, as you say, and as I point out in the book, in actuality, the amount of resource used to kill the Jews was vanishingly small. So I don't have the exact statistics in my head, and I borrowed them from Peter Hayes, who has a fantastic analysis of the Nazi railways. And he shows that this does not include the Holocaust by bullets, but if you look at the number of trains that were used across Europe to deport Jews to Auschwitz, it's a tiny fraction of one day's railway traffic used by the Reichswehr, the Deutsche Bahn, in any given day. So it's really, and of course it's spread across several years. So it's really a tiny number of trains, and to add to the horror for those being deported, of course, they were the least important traffic on the railway system. So one of the reasons why it often took so long for people deported, even from places relatively close to Auschwitz, such as Budapest, to reach Auschwitz was because trains would sit in sidings for hours on end whilst military transports passed first because they had priority. The same is true generally of the Holocaust. And I also mentioned this in the book, that when you look at, you know, we have this idea of Auschwitz as the apogee of modern design and functionality and so on. Actually, the death camps were thrown together for the most part. Yes, of course, the entranceway to Birkenau has this kind of modern Bauhaus design, grand entrance. But really, the rest of it, you know, we're talking about wooden barracks and scavenged material from local villages.
Yeah, I hadn't occurred to ask this, but so a little bit of background. As listeners know, I take students to Europe, and in the past, I've often taken them to Auschwitz. This past summer, our university was not willing to pay the additional insurance costs to go to Poland, given the conflict in Ukraine. And so we went to Mauthausen instead. Surprisingly, I lived in Vienna. I've been to Austria, I don't know, two dozen times. I'd never been there. So how has the kind of cultural focus in Western memory on Auschwitz as the key experience or memory of the Holocaust, how has that helped us understand or misunderstand the experience or organization or structure of the Holocaust? That's kind of a broad question. I'll let you run whatever direction you want. But I was... You know, that's what I was reminded of going into Mauthausen, is how have I not been here? And how have I think of myself as relatively well-educated. And yet here I have this image of Auschwitz as the central keystone memory and experience. So I'll just stop there and let you go where you want.
Yeah, it's a very big question. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was to point out that the concentration camp system run by the IKL, so the SS's Inspectorate of Concentration Camps, is not synonymous with the Holocaust. And we still talk, I think, in Western Europe and in the US about the camps. And I think in the popular imagination still, the Holocaust is synonymous with concentration camps. And I think that is because at the liberation, the majority of surviving Jews were discovered at the liberated camps of Dachau, Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, and of course primarily Belsen, where the largest number were. But they were only there because those were Jews that had been evacuated from camps further east on the so-called death marches. So Jews who were being forced out of camps to stop them falling alive into the hands of the Red Army as they were advancing westwards. Those camps were not Holocaust camps in the sense that they were not established, nor were they used for the most part as part of a program to kill Jews. Those were camps that, of course, they changed over time, particularly Buchenwald and Dachau in particular, which was the first camp to be established. And Buchenwald from 1938 onwards, these camps that had long histories, changing inmate populations, mm-hmm. but were not camps for Jews. There were Jews in them, but they were Jews who were often incarcerated as politicals or as homosexuals or other categories of inmates. So they were not killing centres as part of the Holocaust. It's only really late in the war that the Holocaust and the camp system kind of collide with one another. There is a connection, of course, which is that camp guards for Auschwitz and Majdanek were trained at Dachau. Dachau was the main center for training guards. And Ravensbrück, the center for the SS women auxiliaries, also were trained there. And then sent further east to other places. I'm not trying to argue that the concentration camp system is somehow not connected to the Holocaust. Clearly it is. Just the very notion of a camp is obviously crucial to thinking about Nazi Germany. So there is a connection, but the killing process itself was not carried out in concentration camps. So the Operation Reinhardt camps, actually, you know, Belzec, not really camps. It's a kind of misnomer. They weren't camps at all in any meaningful sense. Nobody was incarcerated there, except for a small number of so-called work Jews who were held briefly to maintain the camp carpenters and so on, leather workers and people who worked with animals and such. The vast majority of people sent to those camps were sent there and murdered immediately on arrival. So they never saw the inside of a camp. And of course, something like 40% of the victims of the Holocaust were either killed in ghettos or were shot face to face in, again, this I think is a sort of genocide studies insight, a kind of colonial style mass shootings in the Western Soviet Union. So that is one sort of popular misunderstanding that I try to grapple with in the book. But it's also necessary to be very careful. I'm not trying to decenter Auschwitz either. Auschwitz remains the height of the Nazi killing process. It was not, and I try to make this very clear in the book, it was not this kind of smooth, efficient, Fordist industrial line killing process where people were killed in this kind of painless, lethal chamber kind of way. The whole process is extremely violent, brutal, and unimaginably horrific in terms of, you know, what happened to people from their arrival to their murder and disposal of the bodies. The whole process is vile and brutal in the extreme. But it was, of course, the case that when the ovens and crematoria were running at full capacity, that Auschwitz could kill and dispose of a lot of people very quickly. And it's also, I think, obvious that had the Nazis succeeded, they would have killed far more people there than was, in fact, the case by the end of the war. Nevertheless, it's really in the summer and the start of the autumn of 1942 that the killing process is at its height. So it's not at Auschwitz. It's a combination of the Holocaust by bullets, which was still ongoing at that point, the Reinhardt camps being in operation, and the killings at Birkenau starting in the summer of 1942, that you have this extremely intense killing period of about 6 weeks to 2 months in 1942 that sees a huge proportion of the Holocaust's victims murdered in a very short space of time. So Auschwitz, I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying that Auschwitz is not important, but I'm trying to put it in the context of what had gone before and where the huge numbers of killings actually took place.
You spent a fair amount of the book wrestling with the fact that the Holocaust is driven by Nazis and yet happens in a variety of countries and involves a variety of participants. So I'm just going to start with a quote, and then we can kind of jump off from there. You write, rather than a tale of German occupation, deportation and murder in death camps, the Holocaust looks more like a series of interlocking local genocides carried out under the auspices of a grand project. And I know it's maybe not fair to ask you to expand on that when I've just written it, but I'm not employed to be fair. So I'm just going to ask you, what does it mean to talk about this Holocaust as a series of interlocking local genocides?
Well, again, I think I have to be very clear here. I'm trying to stress the importance of collaboration and the fact that without local collaboration, whether that means of regimes, of institutions or organizations such as auxiliary police battalions or individuals, whether they committed murder or simply stole from their murdered neighbors, the Nazis would have killed fewer people than they did. I think that's clear. Nevertheless, the vast majority of Jews murdered in the Holocaust were killed by Germans.
Yeah.
Right? So German, by which I mean Germans and Austrians, so the full Germans in the sense of the Third Reich. So when, to come to the case of Hungary again, so something like 437,000 Jews were deported from Hungary in the space of 2 months in the spring of 1944. They were rounded up primarily by Hungarian gendarmerie and police. So huge Hungarian collaboration in the process. But they were not murdered by Hungarians. They were murdered by Germans at Auschwitz. And the same is generally the case wherever you look. So the regime in Slovakia, for example, may have been very voluble and eager to deport its Jews, but they wanted the Germans to take the Slovakian Jews off their hands and kill them. The main exception to this is, to some extent, Croatia, I think, where you see in the Jasenovac camp complex the murder of some tens of thousands of Jews, but far more Serbs than the Croats. You know, this was also an opportunity for Serbia to ethnically purify Croatia of Serbs and Roma, as well as Jews, but also in the case of Romania, which is the sole case in Europe of an independent sovereign country allied to Nazi Germany killing Jews off its own bat. Again, it's really important to say only because there was this umbrella project that the Nazis were running, and it was an opportunity. This is how Antonescu thought about it. It was an opportunity for Hungarian nationalists finally to achieve what they wanted, which was to purify the country, to render it ethnically homogeneous. And what the Germans were doing was offering the Romanians the chance to do this. And Antonescu makes speeches where he says, you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. We do it now or we'll never do it. And so in the case of Romania, you see the deportation of Jews from Bessarabia and northern Bukovina to Transnistria, so the area of Ukraine between the Dniester and the Bug rivers occupied by Romania, but to a large extent their murder there, along with the local Jews of Transnistria, those who hadn't escaped with the Red Army after Spring 41. And so the Romanian regime, again, partly only because the Germans refused to take those Jews into the Reichskommissariat Ukraine, are dumped in Transnistria. And the Romanians, whether by omission, i.e. not providing those Jews with any means of sustenance or shelter, or by commission, i.e. mass slaughter, by massacres, which also involved Ukrainian auxiliaries and the so-called Volksdeutsche, the ethnic Germans of the region, killed some region of 300,000 Jews. Only then, and the importance of Romania's sovereignty becomes clear when in the autumn of 1942, the regime then changes its mind and the Antonescu regime does not deport the Jews of the Regat, the old kingdom of Romania, of southern Transylvania, or of the Banat. And so at the end of the war, despite having killed about 300,000 Jews, Romania has the largest surviving Jewish population in Europe. So you have this Romanian paradox, which of course has become very complicated in terms of Romanian memory of the Holocaust and World War. But that's the most, I think, striking example of what I'm trying to illustrate, which is that the Germans drive this process, and it's their idea in a sense, but it chimes with the ideas of lots of nationalists around Europe, from the Quisling regime in Norway to the Vichy regime in France to the NSB in the Netherlands, through to The Salo Republic in Italy after the summer of 43, through to the aspirations of the more extreme elements of the Hungarian regime and the Romanian and elements in the Baltic states and so across the whole of Europe, including in Poland, which was meant to be wiped from the map by the war. You see parts of the population who are willing to throw their lot in with the Nazis, not only on an opportunistic basis, but also for ideological reasons. This idea of the Nazi new order in Europe, i.e. this demographic reshaping of Europe so that the Aryan race and its kindred racial communities across Europe should come to the fore, was highly appealing to certain sections of the European population.
And you, in your discussion of Romania, you actually engage visibly in a way that I think maybe is more broadly under the surface in your discussion. You engage Tim Snyder in his discussion from his book, The Black Earth. And I encourage listeners, it's a great book. I encourage people to go back and listen to him talk about it. He argues that it's precisely where states are weakest that the most Jews died. And you use Romania as a kind of a counterpoint to that. So I wonder, that's actually a really interesting and important claim in a much broader sense than simply the Holocaust. So I wonder what you would say about this claim that strong states can, in fact, and do often protect minorities in contrast to what we usually think.
That's a hard question.
It's why they pay me the big bucks.
Yes. I think that, look, with respect to the Holocaust, I think what Tim says about is primarily about Poland. I mean, that's his main focus, right? And in that case, it's correct, quite clearly, that the Nazis aimed to destroy the Polish state, which in any case was on the verge of introducing its own anti-Semitic measures before September 1939. And in the process of doing that, they murder the largest Jewish community in Europe. So fully half of the Holocaust victims come from Poland in its 1939 borders. So I think he's absolutely correct. And I'm only mentioning the Romanian case in that respect because Tim sets out that argument as a kind of truism more broadly. And I think the Romanian case does show the opposite, which is that here you have a state that, for whatever reason, I'll come back to that in a moment, decides that it's not going to deport and kill some of its Jews. And I guess your question about the state is, it's making me think that states can protect minorities. First of all, modern liberal democracies are supposed to be committed to that idea anyway, that we live in states that have a kind of empty, homogeneous notion of citizenship. So it doesn't matter what your background is. If you're a citizen of the country, you have rights to live in the country. But states can also protect minorities for geopolitical reasons or issues of realpolitik. And that's what's happening in the case of Romania. I don't think that the 350,000 surviving Jews in Romania in 1944-45 were there because the Antonescu regime had suddenly discovered humanitarianism and or philo-Semitism. They were there because Romania wanted to hang on to the territories it had reacquired from the Soviet Union, primarily Bessarabia and northern Bukovina at the end of the war. And it also wanted to reacquire northern Transylvania, handed over to Hungary after the Second Vienna Award in 1940. And Antonescu could clearly see which way the wind was blowing and thought, as various opposition politicians had warned in 1941, that, you know, by entering Soviet territory, this was not the way to secure territories that had been handed over. And so his thinking was to hedge his bets a little bit and to try and get in good terms with the Allies and hopefully to hang on to the reacquired territories. I mean, it was never going to work, with the exception of northern Transylvania. So obviously after the war, Bessarabia and northern Bukovina became part of, Moldova, the Moldovan Soviet State Republic and part of the Ukrainian Soviet State Republic, respectively. So there you see, I think, a prime case of the protection of Jews aimed not at saving their lives because inherently lives are worth saving, but because they were negotiating chips in a wider geopolitical or territorial series of interlocking questions. The same is true, I think, of Italy. So the case of the Italians as brava gente, there's, you know, they're simply inherently nice people who didn't want to harm the Jews, is, I think, runs up against the problem that what you see when the Nazis try to pressurize the Italians to deport the Jews is a refusal, not because, again, not because the Italians love the Jews, but because they want to retain a sense of their own sovereignty. And this is a matter of pride, especially for a regime, for the fascist regime that had been the kind of inspiration in many ways for Hitler's, and then to have to play second fiddle to the Third Reich was somehow humiliating for Mussolini and for the fascists. And so sort of hitting back on Jewish policy was a way of asserting sovereignty more than anything else. You only have to look what happened with the creation of the Salo Republic to see that there was plenty of violent anti-Semitism in the fascist regime, and that the Risiera di San Saba was a functioning death camp on Italian soil, admittedly then under German occupation, but certainly again with plenty of Italian collaboration there. So your wider question beyond the Holocaust, I'm kind of struggling a bit with, but I think the point is clear that states can protect minorities, not necessarily out of humanitarian concerns, but for geopolitical or territorial reasons or other diplomatic reasons that I think come into play in certain instances.
We've got maybe 10 minutes left. And I'd like to turn to the question of memory. And particularly, I'd like to turn to the question of memory over the past 20 years. You have a discussion of the first half of the chapter that addresses memory that looks at this period from the 40s through the 90s. And that's a really interesting and important section. I'll just point readers to it. But your section on the 21st century is considerably, I don't know, more pessimistic, more clouded. I don't know what the right word is. So can you say a little bit about how you think about the memory of the Holocaust as having become increasingly troubled and controversial in these last couple decades?
I set out in that chapter a rather simplistic narrative of what I called, on the one hand, a progressive narrative of Holocaust memory. Mm-hmm. So the idea that Holocaust memory defends or promotes human rights, asserts equality, notions of equality and freedom and tolerance and so on, and how that, and then I turn to Holocaust memory in the post-truth age and show how that progressive narrative of the Holocaust has been undermined or usurped to some extent by the, I was going to say misuse, but all use is always a misuse. So I mean, Holocaust memory is always used in one way or another, but by the deliberate use of Holocaust memory by movements and regimes that on the face of it do not appear to support those sorts of progressive notions. So appealing to Holocaust memory, for example, to defend, but on the part of far right political groups in Western Europe, in order to say we have to defend liberal democracy from radical Islam. And that Holocaust memory is a way of saying, well, Muslims hate Jews, and therefore we're going to support Holocaust memory because it's a way of demonizing Islamism. Or, for example, again, to talk about an obvious case that I mentioned at the start, the way in which the Putin regime has talked about denazifying Ukraine, you may have seen in the news that the kind of maverick politician George Galloway won a by-election in Rochdale last week, standing on the platform of support for Palestinians in Gaza, in a town with a very large Muslim population. Mm-hmm. His comment was, Very interesting, again, to see a kind of Holocaust metaphor appealed to. That his when asked about this, he said, "Well, if it was 1940 or 1941, nobody would have thought it strange if I'd brought up the issue of the Holocaust. And yet here I am defending, bringing up the issue of a genocide, and people find it objectionable." And actually, I mean, his dates were wrong for starters. That had he mentioned the genocide of the Jews in 1940 or 1941, he'd have been ahead of the curve. He would have known something that wasn't actually happening yet. But irrespective of that, you can see that what's I think this is in bad faith, in the same way, obviously, that when Putin appeals to the memory of the Great Patriotic War and the eradication of Nazism from Ukraine, or in the last few days from Germany, it's clearly in bad faith, because this is the promotion of a long-standing, very powerful narrative in Russian collective memory to promote what is effectively fascism in Russia. So it's completely inverted our standard frameworks for understanding the Holocaust and what Holocaust memory should do. And that progressive narrative still exists. I think most mainstream commemorative and educational organizations dedicated to Holocaust memory strongly believe in and support that notion of the message of tolerance and human rights and so on that Holocaust education and Holocaust memory should promote. But there are, if you look at Viktor Orban's regime, obviously Putin, obviously certain far right movements across Europe, Western as well as Eastern Europe, you see. This kind of what I think is a bad faith appeal to Holocaust memory, but for ends that are not designed to promote harmony between people.
I had Carol Rittner and John Rock on the show, I don't know, a couple years ago about one of their edited compilations, and that they start that particular, I think it's Advancing, I can't remember the title of the book now, I've interviewed them several times, but they start the introduction of that book by basically saying Holocaust education has failed. And so I wonder if you share that perception or fear. And what it would look like if Holocaust education succeeded? What would that look like?
Well, it depends who you ask, I suppose. If you, it seems to me that many people who fund Holocaust education think that what it will do is eradicate anti-Semitism. I think that's unproven. There are now some empirical studies. There are some studies that say that students who have studied the Holocaust at school self-report that they are more tolerant, more unlikely to become bystanders, and so on. I think that's wishful thinking. I think most of the studies by sociologists of education and psychologists and others, social psychologists, suggest that it has no impact at all. I don't mean no impact. We clearly live in a world that is different from the interwar period. Although perhaps not as different as it should be, given current trends. But we do, those of us who live in what still are just about liberal democracies, I suppose, live in places where, officially at least, everybody has equal rights, irrespective of race, background or religion or skin color and so on. And yet, I think that there is very, it's not hard to spot. And it's not hard to whip up a kind of casual racism or casual hatreds of other people when governments drive that agenda. The demonization of migrants, of asylum seekers, of Muslims, of homosexuals, of trans people, et cetera, all of these things are very easy to whip up. And so the idea that and this is the paradox, of course, that Holocaust education has been compulsory in most Western states for the last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years. And in that period, we've seen a rise of the radical right across the same places. And this kind of flummoxes people who promote Holocaust education. But to my mind, it's asking Holocaust education to do far too much, to do more than it can possibly. I'm not against Holocaust education, but I think, first of all, it should be taught in history, not in civics or religion. It shouldn't be used to illustrate the dangers of bullying and so on. You don't need gas chambers to tell kids why bullying isn't pleasant. But it's if we think that the Holocaust education is going to effectively solve the problem of world peace and make people nicer, I think we're really fooling ourselves that the Holocaust education will find its place when we create more equal societies in the first place. And will, in other words, create a situation where the message about Holocaust education will be heard and received. Because at the moment we live in a situation where I think because of the politics of austerity of the last 15, 20 years, people can hear that message, they can agree with it, but when they feel that their life chances are narrowing, those messages go out of the window. And it's we can see it at the moment. It's all too easy for political movements to win support by demonizing minority population groups. And simply, the answer is not simply more Holocaust education. It's a much bigger political problem.
Well, there's way more in this book than we've had a chance to talk about. And so listen, I would suggest to listeners that they go out and they buy the book and they read it themselves. I think you'll find it a good, maybe I should say, Dan writes well, and he writes well in ways that in theory mean you should be able to read it quickly, but in practice means you will, if you're anything like me, continue to stop and have to think about something that you just read, which is, I think, the best recommendation for a book. So I'll just conclude by asking one or two final questions, the same ones I always ask. First is, if you had to recommend a book, or maybe two, maybe it's a movie, maybe it's something else. But my spring break is next week, and I would love to have something to do that does not involve writing a grade on a piece of paper. can you suggest to the listeners a book or something that you found important in your thinking about this subject, either directly or indirectly?
Yes, this is an extremely hard question because the historiography now is so mountainous that there are so many interesting books being published in all sorts of different directions. I would like to recommend, I think because of the current situation, Bashir and Amos Goldberg's edited book on the Nakba and the Holocaust, which was already a very brave book when it was published and has now acquired even more significance than it already had. In what's, you know, a horrific situation where many people appear to have lost their heads, they offer, and the contributors to that book offer, I think, some very clear and reasonable and certainly thought-provoking ways of trying to think about the ways in which the Holocaust and Holocaust memory and the situation in Gaza are imbricated. So that's one for a. There are so many interesting books, but another interesting collection, more specialist, that has been published recently is a book called More Than Parcels by Jan Lanicek and Jan Lamberts, which is a study of aid to ghetto and camp inmates during the Third Reich, and a very kind of detailed study of the mechanics of postal services and how parcels got through to inmates and then to refugees as well in the late stages and aftermath of the war in different settings across Nazi occupied Europe. It's really, in terms of taking pleasure in historical research and seeing how historians can use archives inventively and in new ways, it's a really nice edited collection.
Well, I will inform my students that I have a new assignment and they'll have to wait for their grades, and I will blame you.
I'm sorry.
So expect troubled or angry emails from my students if they can track you down. In the meantime, now that you've written the synthesis, what are you working on next? Are you staying with the Holocaust? Are you looking at something new? What's up for you?
Well, I also published last year a book that I'd been working on for a long time on the International Tracing Service, which was a big monograph on the ITS and showing how among its 30 million documents, you can find stuff that allows us to approach the history of the Holocaust from unexpected ways, by which I mean from a kind of grassroots or bottom-up perspective, even though we're largely using Nazi documentation still, but the documents in the ITS archives allow us to trace the trajectory of people through the Nazi camp system and through various parts of the Holocaust and afterwards. So I've also got sections there on the liberation and the DP camps and beyond. So I'd still have a few loose ends of ITS research that I want to work on. I recently finished a little study on psychoanalysis and Holocaust survival that's coming out with Palgrave later this year, and I'm going to write a book on the Holocaust in Romania. I found working on that for the Unfinished History so fascinating that I think it, and when I've talked about this in public settings, the response I think from people in the general public, not specialists, is always, "I didn't know that." And the names of these places where massacres took place, like Bogdanovka and Akhmechetka and so on, have no resonance in the English-speaking world. And yet what happened there is on a massive scale, and I think deserves to be much better known. So that's my next big project.
We've been talking to Dan Stone about his book, The Holocaust and Unfinished History. Dan, I think you just confirmed people's belief that historians lack a certain sense of work-life balance. But that's okay. I look forward to having you back on the show to talk about your next projects. In the meantime, thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.